Thanks very much for that introduction, Jeremy. And thanks very much, Mike, for hosting us here this evening. And in particular, thanks very much, Deborah, for all the organization of the whole project. So what I'm going to do tonight is just give you a bit of an overview. Jeremy's done some of that, but I'm just going to pick out some of the main things from the work which has been released today, and then just a little bit about where to from here. So I think this, as Jeremy said, this is a good example of collaborative effort that encompasses academic research, but with a very applied focus, and that's certainly not always the case. So why focus on the financial sector? Well, the financial sector plays a unique role in the functioning of the economy. It acts as the intermediary between the myriad saving and spending decisions of households, business, government, both domestic and foreign. And in doing so, it's unlike any other part of the economy, really. And as I've said before, the financial sector is not at the end of a production chain producing something which directly generates value for society. Even though they'd like to think that sometimes. Rather, it's a critical link along the way, and it's the oil basically that keeps the economy ticking over. And when the oil dries up, the economic engine starts to malfunction and can ultimately grind to a halt. So in that sense, the set of papers that we have here tonight gets right to the heart of the issue of how well that oil is working and whether there's any risk of it drying up in the future. Now, there's clearly been a lot going on in the financial sector over the past few years in the global financial sector, and at various times, some channels of financial intermediation have actually seized up in the past few years, much more so offshore than onshore. So the question at the heart of these set of papers is one which is very well worth posing. It is also very timely, as the financial sector is still undergoing considerable change as it adjusts to the lessons that have been learnt over the past few years, and more particularly the regulatory changes that are coming down the pipe along with that. So as I said, I'll try and give a quick overview of the work that has been done as part of this project and talk a bit about where to from here. But the main point I want to get across, and it's what Jeremy has also said this, is you should actually take the time to read each of these three papers. They each provide plenty of food for thought. But before getting to the papers individually, it's worthwhile thinking about what the exercise as a whole is about. So basically, there are four main things. It's assessing the future demand and supply of finance in Australia, considering the interaction between the different participants in the financial system, identifying the potential challenges that face the system, and outline the institutional or regulatory changes that might improve the operation of the system. So as you can see, that's a fairly easy set of four questions to answer. So in looking at the papers, where I think they are most useful is in providing a clear, well-articulated framework to think about these issues. And such a framework, I think, has often been lacking in the debate that has gone on at various times over the past few years, both locally and globally. So to take one current example, and this is on the G20 agenda at the moment, and that's the lack of, well, the question is whether there is a lack of infrastructure funding out there at the moment. But to be able to answer this question appropriately, we need to know whether it is a problem for financing different stages of a project, what type of risk is holding any financing back, what type of institutions are lacking, what type of instruments are lacking, or if none of those are a problem. But there's a whole set of questions which come with that, and you need to have a coherent framework in mind to be able to do this, to know what are the right questions to actually be asking. So the papers, as Jeremy said, commissioned for stage one of the project, they're designed to set the scene. So Kevin Davis's paper, Funding Australia's Future, From Where Do We Begin, provides a very insightful overview on a number of topics. Now let me step back and give a brief disclaimer here. Kevin was my first macro lecturer back in the day, so I'm very much in debt for all he's taught me about macro and monetary economics, so of course I'm going to say good things about him. Yeah. The first main point in Kevin's paper is the identification of the ways in which the Australian financial system differs to other developed economies, and there are quite some important differences. Secondly, it discusses the main consequences of the financial crisis for financial flows in Australia. The current configuration of financial flows today are a hell of a lot different from where they were 5 or 6 years ago. And he also talks about some of the more fundamental forces influencing the longer-term evolution of the sector. Lastly, it identifies some of the implications of these influences. For instance, it links changes in the competitive advantage of banks in raising deposits to changes in the nature of the loan origination process. He talks a fair bit about the length of the financial intermediation chain and also focuses a lot on the overall cost of intermediation. Daniel Molino's paper on Improving Australia's Financial Infrastructure provides a comprehensive overview of what the Australian financial system does well and summarises current and prospective issues. While Daniel notes that the sector performs well in supporting the economy, he argues there are a number of issues that are worthy of further explanation. In doing so, he highlights, for instance, the potential improvements to the payment system, the financing of greenfield infrastructure and high-risk innovation projects, and the arrangements around post-retirement savings products and the regulation around self-managed super funds. He notes that in some areas, such as the payment system, there is already considerable work underway by agencies, particularly us. In other areas, such as infrastructure funding, he notes that Australia is not alone in dealing with some of these challenges, and as I said, that's one of the main focuses of the G20 agenda at the moment. Rod Maddock and Pete Monckton's paper, The Future Demand and Supply of Finance, considers the longer-term availability of funding for Australia's economic growth, the composition of those funding flows, and the role of regulation in their determination. As such, it sits between the other two papers and it provides a longer-run analysis of the flow of funds in the economy. In fact, it goes all the way back to the domestic saving rates back in the 1870s, as well as a broader overview of the role of regulation on those flows. It places a much greater emphasis on the flows within the system rather than the balance sheet structures. Overall, it concludes that the demand for and supply of funds should align over coming years, although there are a number of factors that might alter this balance and hence the cost of intermediation. But the market in the end will clear, it's just a question of at what price. And I think that last point is a particularly important one. The experience over the past few years in Australia shows that even in the most stressed of circumstances, the financial sector can often adapt and re-equilibrate to quite dramatic changes in circumstances. That might involve sizable changes in prices, but I think the whole point, one of the main points of Pete and Rod's analysis is it's important to look at things from the general equilibrium perspective rather than analysing things in a partial manner. The financial system is that. It's a system with a high degree of interconnectedness. A number of other general lessons can also be gathered from the papers. So as noted by Kevin, the financial sector influences the amount of aggregate risk-taking in the economy. It affects how that risk is distributed. So the financial sector doesn't just intermediate funds, it also intermediates risk. And in doing so, it can either amplify or moderate the effects of shocks to the system. The structure and activities of the financial sector are the outcomes of numerous forces over very long periods of time. That comes from Pete and Rod's paper. Looking at aggregate information or one aspect in isolation can often be misleading. As I said, this is true when we are looking at the capital flows into and out of Australia, for instance. The net flows, which are often what people focus on, conceal a lot of important information that is only evident if you look at the gross flows. Another example is thinking about the financing of the corporate sector, where the preference of debt versus equity funding varies considerably depending on the nature and the size of the business. The decision that BHP matters is a hell of a lot different from the decision that your local corner store matters in terms of its financing. Stocks matter at least as much as flows. Just as a disproportionate amount of analysis is partial rather than general, stocks are very often neglected in favour of flows. Just as well as on the price side, levels are often neglected in favour of focusing on rates of change. The financial system is always evolving in both cyclical and structural senses. So in terms of cyclical aspects, financial institutions currently, today, have a much better appreciation of liquidity risk than they did 6 years ago. But if history is any guide, at some point in the future, that appreciation of liquidity risk is likely to wane, unless John has something to do about with that. For example, the lesson from the runs on some deposit-taking institutions and trusts in the early 1990s, or if you go all the way back to concerns about liquidity in Sydney's early days as a colony, be they rum or otherwise, there aren't too many around in the financial sector who remember that, but those lessons are clearly forgotten. The financial system is also continuously evolving in a structural sense. There are a large array of products out there today that simply didn't exist 2 decades ago. In some cases, their arrival has not always been a good thing. In other cases, such as that of asset-backed securities, or going back a bit further, junk bonds, a new product arrived, the market grew too fast too quickly, there was considerable dislocation, and then eventually the market settles back down, and that product becomes an important part of the functioning of the financial landscape. The factors driving evolution are sometimes very similar over the decades, but some factors fade in importance and new drivers emerge. For example, the increasing size of super funds has played an important role in influencing the shape of the financial sector in Australia for the past couple of decades, and I think it's a fair bet that given its current size, is likely to continue to do so for the foreseeable future. In contrast, unlike the 1990s, we no longer talk about how life insurance officers' mortgage lending activities might return to their 1950s and 1960s level of importance. That one's probably not coming back anytime soon. More generally, how the system evolves to these forces is impossible to fully comprehend ahead of time. 20 years ago, for example, it would have been very hard to see exactly how the competitive dynamics would play in the banking sector. In the housing loan market, for example, discounts became increasingly common and increasingly larger, while in the credit card markets, banks initially competed not through price but through loyalty programs, for instance. Likewise, while people understood that new distribution methods in the banking sector were likely to evolve, few would have guessed that the move from ATMs and telephone banking to internet banking and banking on mobile phones would have occurred. So this reflects the fact that technology progresses in ways that we can't imagine. That's true everywhere, but it's true particularly in the financial sector. Society's attitudes towards efficiency and risk evolve and are very much shaped by the course of history. Someone born in the Depression had a different attitude to risk than a baby boomer, who in turn probably has a different attitude to risk or had a different attitude to risk than someone gaining financial literacy today in the current environment. So a key consequence of that last point is that the industry and regulators have to ensure that institutions are resilient to short-term shocks, but are also able to adjust to longer-term secular trends with adequate consideration for both competition and financial system stability. So with these three papers providing a solid foundation, where to from here? So just as there are differences in opinions on some of the issues raised in these papers, there will also be different views about how to prioritise these areas for the next stage of the review. But as I said earlier, I think one of the most useful outcomes of the work to date is the articulation of a coherent framework with which to consider the questions. That said, I think one of the areas that requires more work is one which is very much in a state of flux at the moment, namely the implementation of the vast global regulatory reform agenda. A holistic view of how the Australian and the global financial system is being transformed by this would be very welcome and is much needed right at the moment. Finally, a particularly useful outcome of this project is that bringing together many of the key participants in the sector to discuss the issues and provide a fruitful forum with which to do so. And I think, if nothing else, that's what this exercise very much achieves. So I thank Deborah and the ACFS for their efforts in coordinating that work, and the wish the participants luck in this regard, as well as again commending the amount of work already accomplished. And as I said earlier, the main thing you can do, as Molly used to say, do yourself a favour and go and read the papers. I think that's they're a very useful body of work, a very useful start to this whole project. And as I said, the best thing you can do is to read them. So with that, thanks very much.
Any surprises in the results of the three papers? Certainly for us, they're some good consolidation of information. But...
yeah. I think... I said the best thing which came out of it, and I think something which was lacking, was the articulation of a coherent framework. Because there are a lot of time things are said which I find don't take account of the fact, as I said during the speech, that the financial system is actually a system. So when stuff changes in one area, something else is probably going on somewhere else. Prices and quantities adjust. You know, it's a financial market. So.
Guy, you talk about a state of flux, I think, in the global regulatory reform. What do you mean by that? What are the examples of that?
There's just a lot going on. I mean, the FSB work agenda and underneath, the Basel Committee is not underneath the FSB, but alongside that, the Basel Committee, the work coming out of the Basel Committee and other bodies, there's just a lot happening at all levels and across pretty much all parts of the financial system. And the work agenda has been pretty intense for the last few years. And a lot of the stuff is now seeing the light of day. And while pretty much all the initiatives are worthy in and of themselves, they interact with each other, and I'm not sure that anyone is stepping back and having a look at how they interact with each other. Doesn't mean that they're not appropriate, it's just no one's actually done that or doing that, really. There have been some exercises in the aggregate, but no one, I think, has sort of stepped back and say, well, all of this is going on, what effect is this going to have? So it doesn't mean that necessarily the wrong thing's being done, just that's probably a useful question to know the answer to sometime fairly soon, I think. And as I said, a lot of this is now coming into force around about now, over the course of the next 12, 18 months. So That's why I think there's a, you know, that's a useful exercise for someone to do.